reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions by myself and Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you. Let the journey begin.
Join us.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live from the snowy, frozen wasteland of Rochester, New York. I want to thank everyone for joining me today on the Paranormal Radio Network. And you can also hear us on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. For more information on the show and on my guests, visit my webpage by clicking on the banner for Through the Keyhole at www.paranormalradionetwork.com. If you're listening live tonight just to the audio, be sure to join us sometime on the message board. You can discuss the program and add your questions and comments. Go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com, and you can pretend the conversation through instant messaging. Pal Talk is a free download. It does take a few minutes to get in the first time, but then you can follow in the conversation. The audio will begin automatically when you enter the chat room. You can also email me anytime with your questions and comments. My email address is kdolan@rochester.rr.com. Or if you prefer, you can always call into the show toll-free. That number is 1-877-786-0562. I would like to thank my good friend Peter Robbins for joining me this evening. It's been way too long.
Yes, good to be back, Karen.
Now, I did get to see you recently, which was fun.
Indeed. You and I and a certain other person whose name I forget at the moment constituted a very small but very good little conference on the last day of this year, the 31st of December. Oh, yeah, his name is Richard Dolan, that's right.
Oh, yeah, him.
Yeah, Karen and Rich and I spoke at a really wonderful, it's had quite a number of UFO speakers over the past years, just outside of Philadelphia. And this was special to us because it was a benefit for a really outstanding little public access television station in Philadelphia called Radner Studio 21. And one of the reasons that I wanted to get involved in this is the station director there, longtime public TV guy, explained to me, with all the deregulation over the years of media venues, that a lot of seemingly public access stations around the country, mostly very small operations, have quietly been bought up by corporations. And they still have the basic look and feel of a public access venue, but they're not. And we raised some money for them. We had a great time. I think Karen and Rich's talks were absolutely fascinating. And then we got to all spend New Year's Eve together with dear friends and had a great, great couple of days.
Well, I have to say that I really enjoyed your presentation as well, Peter, and especially the touches of your personal memories that came out in there.
That was as they say, that was personal. the talk that I gave was on the United Nations failed initiative in 1978 to do something that would have really made history, which was to establish a permanent ongoing committee to study and develop policy around the UFO phenomenon. Realistically, its chances were slim, but the prime minister of a very small Caribbean country, Grenada, that the United States courageously invaded under President Reagan some years later, had pushed this initiative for some years previous. And it was actually my first, you know, UFO-related job of any consequence. I was very new to the field. But my new buddy in it, that was somebody named Anton, on to become a very distinguished presence over the decades, and I worked as editors on a paper for the Secretary General, and we got to witness the meetings, and they were absolutely riveting, and so I shared my memories of it as well as all the documented material that I had kept from it. So it was a special opportunity to do that with a terrific audience on the last day of this year.
It was a lot of fun. And we did. We were hosted by some really wonderful people who were there at the for a New Year's party. And a loop blast. Just a wonderful time with some really wonderful, wonderful people in the Philadelphia area.
I should
area.
Say here, you know, I think it will loom large in Rich's legend, but our good friend Jeff, whose family and friends we saw it in with, he is, among other things, he's kind of a Renaissance man as far as I'm concerned, but he is, among other things, a absolutely professional level magician and has been so for many years. And his son Brandon, who's I think 19, seems to be in the process of becoming a full professional. And right after the new year came in, he asked Rich if we could saw him in half. Well, not we, but he. And Rich, ever game, said yes. He was laid out on a table. A kind of wooden frame was put over him. And I expected, you know, a big old-fashioned saw, but Brandon pulled out a skill saw with that vibrating blade, placed a towel under Rich in case anything went horribly wrong and we needed to collect the blood, and then cut right through him, and miracle of miracles, he seems to still be in one piece. And then Brandon allowed Rich to belt him up in an absolutely no-tricks, regulation-issue, insane asylum straitjacket. I checked all the buckles, and then we watched him wiggle right out of it. It was pretty surreal and a great way to see him the new year.
You know what keeps sticking with me is, you know, when Brandon told us about the time he performed this in front of an audience, and one woman was very upset because she works in a mental hospital.
Yes.
And she did not want to think that anyone could get out of this.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
It was. And then Rich tied him up again in a chair with a 50-foot length of rope. No tricks or anything. I mean, tied him up with lots of knots, and Brandon wiggled right out of that.
Got out.
Shades of Harry Houdini. Amazing.
No kidding.
I'm sure we'll be hearing more from him in the future. And this is, as you know, kind of an interesting transitional night at my house here, where, as you and Joe called for my cue to come in, we had.
I was just going to say, you brought home a souvenir of that weekend.
It is true. When we were staying at our friend Jennifer's and Michael's in Philadelphia, they had two foster young cats, 10 months or so, and we've been needing a replacement cat here, so the adoption was struck, and the delivery was made 5 minutes before showtime, and I'm looking at a photo of him, and no, he's not the one with the white feet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's the one with a lot of attitude and irregulation issue, tiger cat, and
okay.
We're very happy to have him, and he's roaming around somewhere right now.
Oh, good. You know, that was so funny when, for the benefit of our listeners, you guys missed all this, when we called Peter to get the show started.
Very young character.
Just opening, and his cat was just coming in. Okay, we'll call you back.
Hence why we've started a few minutes late.
Yep.
And cat lovers all over the world will understand.
Mm. Who love cats, who live with cats, we who serve cats.
Yeah.
I live with three. I'm totally underfoot.
Yeah,
I serve them. That's all I do around here.
Some people feel it was the Nephilim or other ancient races that settled and kind of set up our fate as human beings. We know better. Mm-hmm. It was cats.
Well, you know that whole thing about worshiping cats in ancient Egypt?
Mm, yeah.
The cats have never forgotten this.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. And still demand it of some of us.
Yeah. Now, Peter, you have another conference coming up shortly.
I do, and it's one that you've been involved in for quite some time, although I'm not sure if you're going to be out there this year, but yeah.
I don't know if I can. I really, really, really want to, but...
That's three reallys. We hope that you'll be able to make it.
I know. That's three reallys, people.
Yeah. I'll be back out at the International UFO Congress next month in Phoenix, and very much looking forward to it. As I'm sure some of your listeners know, last year was the first year under, so to say, new management. The IUFOC has been run extremely well by a terrific group of friends and advisors who have made it a success for 19 years out of a tiny little border town in Arizona, right on the Nevada border there, called Laughlin. And it was 7 days long, would have 40 speakers from, 10 countries, 8 nights, mm-hmm. and up to 1,000 people in attendance. There's no event like it in America. So a number of us were understandably concerned when the great folks at Open Mind picked up the reins and brought it to Phoenix last year for the first time. As you know, because you were there the whole time, I was only there briefly, they drew in well over 1,200 people. It's now running 4 days and over 20 speakers. And it was a tremendous success, and I'm very excited to be part of it this coming, this second annual in Phoenix, but I believe the 21st annual International UFO Congress. And for anyone interested, whether or not you're in the Southwest, if you're interested in UFOs and you've always been, reticent about going to one of these things, feeling that you're going to be surrounded by people in pyramid-shaped hats spouting nonsense, those conferences do occasionally exist. But overall, UFO conferences are very well run and quite scientific, and this one is kind of the godfather. It's a terrific opportunity to hear some of the best, some of the most controversial, and certainly some of the longest-term researchers, investigators, and authors in the field. It runs from the 16th to the 22nd to the 26th of February.
Right.
And you can find out about it by simply Googling IUFOC, at 2012 or going to the Open Minds website.
I believe you can also get to it by just going to www.ufocongress.com.
Brilliant. That'll That's a good URL to have.
Yeah.
Yes. And so, yeah, my talk is going to be on our old friend and really up until August, arguably the best known and most highly regarded person in the field internationally, bar none, and that was Bud Hopkins, who passed at the age of 80, again last August, and I'll be giving a remembrance of him and very much looking forward to doing so.
It's very appropriate that you should be doing that, Peter. Your association with Bud went back so far. You were really involved with him in the very early days of this research.
Yeah. 1843, I think we started. I was very fortunate, and you're right. We met very shortly after both of us became involved in the mid-70s, and were already good friends by the time that his first book, which really blew the door open on serious study of abduction phenomena, that was Missing Time, was published in 1981, and I had the great good fortune to work as his assistant on and off over the next couple of decades.
And that is still really a brilliant book. You know,
it sure is.
All of the new books that have been coming out, there in the last few years, it seems like there are just more and more and more books. Everyone involved is writing more books, which is great. We're getting a lot of information out. But Bud's books still, you know, they have not been eclipsed by any of the new work. He was such an amazing writer.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Karen. And I've been rereading parts of Missing Time and Intruders and Witnessed and his other books in preparation for this talk, and reminded of something that I used to tease him about, because it drove me crazy in a very good way as a writer. I don't know if I know a writer who is better at getting out a first draft that is close, if not almost right there as the final draft. I was just amazed at his consistent ability to put it all together. A highly literate man, very well read, extremely passionate about the work, and one of our really true goodwill ambassadors all over the world, and somebody we will all miss, but are very lucky to have known.
Very. He was absolutely such a gentleman.
Yeah.
I only had the occasion to meet him a few times at different conferences.
Mm.
And it just impressed me every time I met him that he was such a gracious person.
Yeah, and he's also...
But that can seem sort of stuffy, and he never was. He had a sense of humor as well. He was just always such fun to be around.
Well, you got that right. I think, you know, for all of us, a good sense of humor is pretty indispensable in life. And I feel bad for people that can, you know, have a little fun at their own expense sometimes. Bud had a wonderful sense of humor. We used to be able to blow off a fair amount of steam sometimes, because the work could be very isolating and sometimes anxiety-provoking. And we shared some quirky tastes. I grew up with listening to the radio growing up in the greater New York area, and there was a radio comedy team that I don't think that anybody has ever come up to them. They had a very, very acerbic, dry sense of humor, and between like 200 characters, and they had a daily show when I was a kid and specials for many years after, and their names were Bob and Ray. And Bud also loved Bob and Ray's comedy. And in the old days, if we wanted to take a break, sometimes we would put on an audio cassette. Some people may have to look that one up on Google.
Remember those?
That he would
before
record.
iPod.
Yeah, that he would literally record with his tape recorder in front of the honking radio. And we would just crack up. They were so funny and so original. He had great taste in music, and God knows we shared a tremendous passion for the arts. but watching him work, and over the years, he worked with, I think, about 1,000 people who had been through the abduction experience. And I was privy to many of those meetings, and it was a tremendous privilege.
You know, when we talked about what a gracious man he was, I'm getting some interference in the sound here.
Yeah, we're both echoing.
A strange echo. Okay.
Oh, Joe.
Hello.
Sounds like we're in the Batcave.
I know, it does. It's weird.
Garrison Keillor's unique radio show, The Prairie Home Companion, which is just sort of the last vestige of the golden age of radio and still running, although Garrison's going to retire soon. And once a year, for anybody arcane enough to still listen to actual radio, Prairie Home Companion has a two-hour show, which is almost nothing but jokes. And if one of us wasn't able to listen to that show, the other one would often tape record it and present it with great glee to the other. And yeah, you know, lots of great memories and lots of ones where you, it was just, well, and I actually have two articles, remembrances, so to some people can read if they'd like. One appeared some months back in Open Minds, our wonderful preeminent UFO magazine in the States here right now, and the other appears in a British online publication called Phenomenon, and you can chase that down on the internet and find that piece in their archive. I'm going to try not to repeat myself in the talk next month, but again, anybody that can't be there, do see if you can avail yourself of the piece. You'll learn a bit about them, and more important, much more important, if you're looking to learn anything about the most challenging area of UFO studies, namely the abduction phenomenon, you can't do better than Bud's writings, and I would strongly suggest that you go online and don't even, you know, don't look to buy a new copy of the books. You can find them used, you know, sometimes for just a few dollars at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and a wonderful book site that I frequent called Abe Books. Abe as in Abe Lincoln.
Oh, yeah, A-B-E.
Yeah, .com. AbeBooks.com. Yeah. And the books are Missing Time, Intruders, Witnessed, Sight on Scene, and his last book, which I think would be of particular interest to people who are not necessarily interested in UFOs, but would be interested in learning more about a unique American life, well-lived. Bud was first and foremost, before he became involved in the field and then still paralleled it, a painter, and an outstanding one. And that book, his memoir, which was published, thankfully, a year or so before we lost him, is Art, Life, and UFOs, which couldn't have a better title.
Fantastic title, I know.
It's a wonderful book, going from Wheeling, West Virginia, through meeting some of the great movers and shaker of the world, and how he got involved as really the pioneer researcher in a field that I think he will be acknowledged for many years in the future as a truly great man.
Yeah.
And for anyone that knew him, I think a really great guy, too.
Mm-hmm. Peter, are Bud's paintings on display anywhere?
Not right now. Our friends Steve and Janice, who I hope are listening right now in London or just outside of there, were really fortunate in being able to purchase a number of works from Bud, as did other people over the years, of course. And he has works in the Metropolitan Museum, as I recall, the Whitney, the Museum of Modern Art, many fine museums all over the country and all over the world. But I believe that a good number of his paintings, are with a small circle of friends, and certainly the lion's share of his artwork is now with his daughter, Grace, who, I would think that some of this is still available. Mm-hmm. And anyone who is fortunate enough to have a Bud Hopkins on their wall, what can I say, as an art lover and somebody that is steeped in the world of painting, I wish I had one. I mean, a big one.
I think I have a postcard that Bud gave me once.
All right, that's a start.
An image of one of his paintings.
Yeah.
It was very cool. There are some questions on the chat room about what kind of paintings he did.
Ah.
And I'm thinking the one that I saw was pretty abstract. It was beautiful.
That's a perfect question. We were of different generations, and when he was coming of age, the school of painting that was the one to follow was abstract expressionism. And his great inspirations as a painter were Franz Kline and William de Kooning, and, painters of that ilk who, for anyone familiar with modern art, these are names that ring a major bell. And when he came to New York, a true dream of his came true, which was Franz Kline essentially took him under his wing and mentored him. And there is a strong feeling of some of Kline's very strong graphic works and some of Bud's work in the 1950s coming into the 60s. It like all artists, his work morphed over the year, a very strong abstract expressionist statement to the world of sculpture, and pieces that even he called temples. And I'm just reaching over here for a catalog of his, and sacred spaces. They were very reflective of some of the most memorable structures, from the Parthenon to Stonehenge to the ancient pyramids in South America and Egypt to Babylonian, Hittite, Roman work. And then they morphed into a series of wall paintings, which he stayed with to one degree or another for the rest of his life, which he called guardians, which were much more precise and highly colorful. And just that word alone says something about them. I'm going to guess if you were to go online and Google Bud Hopkins art, you could chase down a number of examples, but I include some of them in my articles in Open Minds and in Phenomena magazine in the UK. And probably within the next month, we'll be going online with a new website of my own, and it will have a photographic section, and I think I will include some of Bud's paintings in there.
That's wonderful. There are a few more questions here about Bud's painting.
Yeah.
Actually, one person is asking how often he painted. You know, how many did he, was it a sporadic thing, or it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like
that's
pretty prolific, the way you're
great
describing.
Question. I would say,
honestly. And for how many years?
Yeah. Well, he as a boy growing up in West Virginia, he had a passion for the arts that he discusses in great detail that starts, you know, pre-kindergarten. He was always drawing or creating things, and it evolved into his passion, and he graduated from Oberlin with, I'm guessing, a BFA like I did from visual arts. And then in the very early days, could still pursue a dream of entering the New York City art scene because, mm-hmm. you know, rents were very inexpensive then, although, you know, they were pretty dear if you didn't have any money. His story is just this classic one of moving to New York and beginning to, you know, make it as an artist. And it was his full-time work until he really got involved in UFO studies in 1975. And then I think it's fair to say he painted and drew and made his sculptural work whenever he could. I observed sometimes there were pretty prolonged periods when his writing, his work with abductees, once, you know, people from all over the world were writing and requesting parts of his time, he was such a humanist. He did tend to put people ahead of his own needs and sometimes, you know, the needs of his family, per se, and that can be very rough. But I know it was always so great to see him painting and drawing, and when he'd be on the road, especially in Europe, sometimes he would travel with, a small set of drawing materials, and the first time he did this, I was happily shocked. He came back with a series of classic, little, perfect, realistic drawings of, you know, a cityscape on the horizon in England or France or wherever he had been lecturing, or Italy, Turkey, who knew where. And was very proud that he had never lost that classical training. But really, even close till the last year of his life, he was still doing small works, including many, many collages, often ones that he would build up with colored paper on an abstract, you know, a small abstract painting, and whether it was a guardian figure or not, and took a great deal of pleasure in framing them up and giving them as gifts to friends, lucky friends.
Mm.
Yeah.
Very, very lucky friends. A couple more questions is, the question says, what was his best artwork? And then it says most popular.
Uh-huh.
Did he have a piece that really stood out as?
That's in the eye of the beholder. I wouldn't even touch that one.
But there wasn't one that became like really well known to the public?
I don't think so. And that's often the case with abstract mm-hmm. painters. You know, whether it's a Rothko or a de Kooning or a Pollock or...
Mm-hmm. Well, sure, but like with Van Gogh, you can only, I mean, everybody knows Starry Nights.
Well, that's true.
And, you know, there's that one piece that's sort of iconic, this is the work of this artist. You know, was there
true.
A piece like that for Bud?
Well, I would say yes and no. And for people who have immersed themselves in the arts, for me, I would have zoned in on a dozen different Van Goghs that I would have said were emblematic, but I guess in the popular mm-hmm. mind, you're right. But think of it in terms of complete abstraction. If you're familiar with the works of Jackson Pollock, they still mm-hmm. all have a similar sensibility. When I was 25, I had the privilege of working as the studio assistant to a great abstract expressionist, Adolf Gottlieb. And Adolf had been refining his painting for decades, and his mature work was a shape in the bottom center of the canvas and another shape above it. It would usually be a circle at the bottom or something like that, and kind of a cluster of lines of it was a Gottlieb. And again, with an abstract painter, it's often not the case that there is an iconic work, especially in the public mind. So, again, even if there were, I would not want to set myself up for even assuming what you know a best work was. That is something that is completely up to each one of us.
But it wasn't maybe because of the time when he lived. Although that doesn't make sense because, you know, as I said, Van Gogh has Starry Nights that, you know, shows up on coffee cups and things everywhere. Everybody knows that one.
Yep.
In fact, you've seen the restaurant here in Rochester.
Yeah.
It's called Starry Nights, and one entire wall is painted with that picture on it.
Yes.
It's very cool.
It was. And when you brought me there, my jaw dropped because it's quite a good rendition.
Isn't it wonderful?
It was great fun to have our breakfast there that day, you bet. But yeah, another thing that I loved about working with him was that all of our UFO-related work, and that goes for answering all of our letters, and once the Intruders Foundation was established in the 1990s, all of our Intruders-related business was in a corner of his painting studio that had been carved out. So we were always surrounded by his artworks on every day that we worked there together. And for me, it was very inspiring, and it reminded me of, well, when I had my own studio and so many of other studios that I've been in, it's very common, and it's nothing new, for artists to have a board or a wall or a part of their space where they pin up cards, illustrations, little drawings, notes, but in relatively modern times, in the last 100-plus years, postcards are such a common way to get an image out there into the world, and it was no different when Van Gogh was painting than now. And I remember always a wonderful, you know, board, like a large bulletin board with anywhere from, you know, 30 to 50 cards and, you know, small pieces pinned up of everything from classic Greek sculpture to Rembrandt to, you know, the great modernists and Brancusi and Cézanne and Rodin and on, that you just do for the most understandable reason, because you love these pieces and they inspire you around and see a wall, or important to see a wall like that to just refer to as kind of a shorthand for the creativity of artists, and that you are part of it, and what an exciting thing that is. So my only regret for him in a way was that he didn't get to paint more. And for me, getting involved in UFO research completely ultimately displaced my life as a painter, which I resented tremendously, but I was obsessed. Aside from writing, though, at least I have almost always continued to be a photographer throughout this whole period of decades that I've been involved in this field, and I could certainly turn around in the next few years and go back to painting, and may well. But right now, balance between my work in ufology and for Creative Outlet, just keeping that camera right with me all the time and capturing those moments and images seems to satisfy what I need. But
I've seen many of your pictures. Your photos are beautiful.
Thank you.
It's funny that you said that, though, because one of the comments that just came up on the board is someone said the fear of all artists is their works will only be recognized after they pass.
Oh, my.
And, interesting. Well, that's an interesting thought. And I'm thinking that for many artists, it's not a question of worrying about whether they'll be recognized. I like to create things as well. I was an art student. Thank you. I also like to draw. I like to, you know, create fiber arts, all these different things. And I'm sure you understand this as well. Creating art isn't like I want to make something that someone will like so I can sell it. There's something in you that has to get out.
Oh, you got that right.
It is. It's like something you have to kind of come to terms with.
Yeah.
And you have to give it form, and you have to give it its form.
Yeah.
We don't decide. We just kind of interpret.
Well, Bud certainly got recognition in his lifetime, and there's no question about that. And certainly the associated satisfaction that goes into it. However, I'm not talking about your art for decoration or, you know, with all due respect, kind of small town art. I'm talking about the international stage where you are in New York City and you are working for the international art, you know, lovers and acquirers around the world who are a pretty unforgiving lot, as is the world of museum curators and gallery owners. And I can tell you that in so many words, when Bud Hopkins the painter first published a, quote, F.O. book in 1981, attention was paid by the art world, and not of the best kind. The unspoken understanding is that art is your life. You live and die by it and for it. It's above politics. It's above anything else. It is your first love. It is your first passion and obsession. And getting involved in something as quirky or, well, you know, it doesn't look good. How serious can this painter be if he's now involved in thinking that flying saucers are real and I guess the little people that drive them? And it hurt his career. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is an absolute fact, and I can't point to it in any direct way. Had he not gone that route of following something that was that important that he was willing to sacrifice the thing that he loved to do the most as far as creative outlet, he probably would have sold more, had worked in more museums, been more recognized, been written up in more art magazines. And again, not that his, you know, painter resume and CV is not a highly respectable and distinguished one, and the collections, public and private, that his work ended in is something that most of us would have killed for as painters. Imagine having your work in the Museum of Modern Art in New York City and the Whitney and the Metropolitan and great museums in Europe. That's something you can dine off of for the rest of your life on a certain level. But there was that, you know, you're not as dedicated as this one person over, or if this was something that you had kept completely private, you know, maybe we could have cut you a little more slack. And I resented that because it shouldn't have to be that way, but that's the way it is. If, you know, what can I say? Point made.
Well, it sounds an awful lot like academicians saying, you know, for example, you might be getting your PhD in history at a very prestigious university, but don't think you're going to get a teaching job or tenure if you're writing job or writing books about UFOs.
Ooh, exactement. Yep.
You know, I've seen that one pretty close up.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. Well, you're right. It's true.
And, you know, I find it very upsetting. I was surprised when you said that. You would think in the artistic world where they value creativity, and one would think thinking outside the box, I mean, personally, I would think an even more interesting person. Not only is he this phenomenal painter and sculptor and turned out to be a brilliant writer, but he's also open to all these new ideas and these new, you know, open to looking at what really is in life, which I would think would make him a more interesting artist.
No,
but just like in any other field, here's this art hierarchy that says you have to, you know, be creative the way we tell you or don't.
It's more in that you're absolutely right, but the ridicule factor that has attached itself to the subject of UFOs from the summer of 1947 on, which we've discussed on the air in the past and which has been a specialty area of research for me for some years, is I don't think there's any departments or areas of study or ways of making a living that are outside of its grasp. And the arts, per se, is no different. It is tarred with, by the media and by popular culture, with such a goofy, diluted, distorted kind of persona in the mind of so many otherwise, you know, clear-thinking and decent people out there who mm-hmm. are deeply conditioned. So I think there was a certain amount of resentment about that, and I would be willing to bet that many of the people who felt that way in the serious art world certainly never bothered to read any of his books because, well, you know, they have other things to do. They're involved in the arts, and there is a certain, pretense involved. And it's a shame, but I think history will sort it out, and his work will be as highly regarded by those who are keepers of art history as pioneering writings in UFO investigation, especially pertaining to the abduction phenomena, will mark him as a truly great man in the future. And that was something that even on, you know, the darkest days or the loneliest or the most isolating days that we worked together, that was never, ever lost on me for a moment, that I was getting to be, you know, a bug on the wall of something that was truly historic and continues to be, so much so that I don't think we realize we're in the presence of truly significant paradigm-shifting history when it's happening often because it's happening. And it's what we're doing or what we know or, you know, it's something that is going to change things in the future, looking back on this millennia. And, you know, you're like turning a curve, but so slowly in terms of life that you don't feel the turn, if you know what I mean. How fast are we traveling right now? 30-odd right. thousand miles an hour? The room that I'm pretty still, I don't know about where you are, but it's all relative.
Yeah. I used to have a button that said, I may look like I'm doing nothing, but on a cellular level, I'm really quite busy.
I won't. One.
My technology teacher loved it.
That's terrific. Excellent.
Well, Peter, how did Bud Hopkins go from being an artist to being involved in this whole UFO thing? What happened that drew him into it?
I really two things, and I say this from stories Bud told me over the years, and from having the great fun of reading Art, Life, and UFOs when it came out, because I had seen the earliest imaginable draft like 25 years before, after Bud had his first bout with cancer and realized he wanted to do things about his life for his daughter and had formalized the stories that he had told me back then. In 1965, as I recall, he was spending the summer on Cape Cod, which he did for, I think, 50 summers. He and his then-wife, April, were lucky enough, as I recall, to buy a small property in a lovely location at a time when, you know, real people without a lot of money could do that. Now, of course, Cape is to do that if you've got, you know, a more regular human income. And they had a house built on it. And so even this past summer, as I recall, even this past summer, some months before he died, he was able to get in like a week up there, I think. Anyway, he's walking on a beach, and he observed a disc-shaped object coming along slightly out to sea, I think. I'm working from memory here, but it is all laid out in very detail in his memoir. And he watched it, and I think it was a somewhat overcast afternoon, but it was disc-shaped. And he just sort of tracked it with his eyes, never saw anything like it, realized it was that thing that people had been talking about for years that, you know, was a true mystery, and essentially filed it in his mind and went back to work. The real I know this very well because my involvement dovetailed his by a year, and I remember hearing this story from him when we first met. Bud was, when he would drink, he was a Scotch drinker, and his brand was Cutty Sark. And he had taken a walk to the small liquor store in his neighborhood where he would pick up his Scotch. And it was run by an older gentleman, World War II veteran named George Obarski. I met George only once, but he left an indelible impression on me. And George was a crusty old guy. He lived in with his grown-up son. And he was a neighborhood character in part because he didn't drink. He was a teetotaler. Ha ha, big joke, owns a liquor store. Okay. And one afternoon or evening, Bud walks in, and George, who is, you know, always good and chats a bit and, you know, talk about politics, whatever, complain a little bit, he was extremely withdrawn and not very communicative. And Bud asked him what was wrong, and he said he didn't want to talk about it, but Bud was concerned. He liked the guy, and he pushed him, and pushed him a little harder. And George said, "You're not going to believe it, and I don't want to be laughed at in words," and then went on to tell him the story that got Bud Hopkins involved and deeply involved in UFOs, and this was it. George had been doing an inventory, I don't know, a week or two before. Again, don't hold me to the specifics here. It's all in his book. And he didn't leave the shop that night until 1 or 2 in the morning. And I guess went through the Hollander, the Lincoln Tunnel, and was driving back to his home in Jersey along that route that runs right along the East River, you know, in parallels. You've got a great view of Manhattan Island. And when he was at the parallel, if you would have drawn a line across from Manhattan, I think he was in the 80s at that point. And at that time, Mabel, they were still developing that area, and there's only one apartment house. And just to, you know, because this is the way it is, it was designed a lot like the Capitol Records building in Los Angeles, which was very dramatic when it was built, I think, in the 60s. It's round. And there is this round apartment house, not like a ball, of course, but like a column, right there in the, you know, the parallel of the 80s on that Jersey Coast Road. And it's called the Stonehenge. Perfect, right? And coming along, and his radio is starting to develop static, very, you know, increasingly strong. And you remember in the old analog radio days, there was only one way to deal with a radio that was doing that. You bang on the dashboard a couple of times and hopefully it comes back. Didn't help. And again, it's very early in the morning and no other traffic on the road to speak of, and there seems to be a car coming up behind him. And this is right out of Close Encounters. And as it's getting closer, the static is getting worse. And as it comes up behind him and then goes over him, he realizes it is not a car. And it veers to the left, and he watches as he slows down to like zero or almost no miles an hour as it lands very gently in the field, out in back of the Stonehenge complex. And he watches as what you and I would call, you know, some kind of landing gear or, you know, structure comes down. And once it settles in place, this is what happened to George. A stairwell or, you know, whatever you want to call it, drops down, and a number of small humanoid-type beings come down it with...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he's watching this. And this is, I'm sure, a lifelong Republican, probably, and I say this with all due respect, members of, you know, veterans of foreign wars of the American Legion, Roman Catholic. You know, he's an American archetype. He's a World War II veteran. He's a widower. and a very decent guy and a small business owner. And this is not something that he spun out of his head. And he watches as they sort of dig, you know, and they seem to have collection containers. And it all happens in one sequence. And then they go up, and the gangplank comes up, the structure retracts, it shifts slightly, and zoop, it's gone. It's gone. Well, he's telling this to this neighborhood painter who once saw a disc-shaped object, and Bud was really knocked by what he heard. It was a life changer for him. And he asked George if, oh, George, by the way, went on to say then that he went home and, got under the covers. And as George told me when we met, you know, he had seen combat. He had been through situations in his life, but he had never been more frightened than he was that night. And he prayed, he cried. His son, who worked a night shift, came home early that morning, and finds his father in a terrible state and up, and asks him what is wrong, and he says, I will tell you, but you know, you're going to think I'm crazy. And he lays out to his son what I've just related basically to you and our audience friends. Mm-hmm. And his son's reaction was to the effect of, Dad, it's not that I don't believe you, but now, you know, you've got me going on this, and I've got to go out to check for myself. And so his son drives out and pulls off the road there and parks his vehicle and walks out. He finds the damn impressions that were made by, you know, these discs on the bottom of the, you know, the landing apparatus. He finds marks where things have been freshly dug. He comes. And both of their lives change. Well, this is it. And Bud Hopkins begins his very first investigation. And let me tell you, talk about hitting the floor running. This is where I come into the picture. Probably about a year into my own investigation of this subject and completely obsessed with it. And one afternoon, I pick up a copy of the Village Voice, which at the time was a... Well, it still is a weekly, but certainly not known for UFO articles, anything but, very political and very progressive. And there, I think it was on page one, was the first, you know, section of an article on an investigation about a UFO incident written by a guy named Bud Hopkins. And I could hardly believe it. I think it might have been the first UFO article I had seen clippings, you know, of articles already, of course, but I think it was the first one I've come on in my life on my own. And, of course, I bought the paper, I took it home and I read it, and several things really impressed me. I was knocked out by what an extraordinary investigation it was, and that's a whole nother story. The investigation Bud conducted was superb. It was done as though he had received training, you know, as a police detective. In fact, one of the people he interfaced with was a police detective who lived in the Stonehenge building, who was there when it happened, and the doorman observed this happening out of the window. And at first, when he saw the lights in the field, actually the lights around the rim of this craft, he thought it might have been kids parking. But they were too uniform. And as he realized what he was looking at, he lifted the house phone to call the detective who lived in the building. And as he did, the entire plate glass window in front of him crumbled. And they did a forensic investigation, Karen, and they could not find, there was no bullet, it was no BB, there was no radiating out from any specific point that I recall. It just smashed. Bud interviewed a young couple who were up with a colicky baby that night and who saw it out in dough, and so on and so on and so on. Well, it was so well written, and this was what I was looking for. I didn't want to have anything to do with the early books that I was picking up, although I'm delighted I had them in my library, whether it was, you know, George Dembski or the other contactees in Welcome to Space Brothers. I was looking for real investigation and real reality here. And I read the article in one sitting, and I pulled out the New York City phone book. And there was only one Bud with two D's, as we know, Hopkins, in the greater New York area. And I took a deep breath, and I just called him. What was in the back of my mind was the art world in New York is, you know, we didn't all know each other, and I was a relative nobody at the time, but I was an aspiring painter, and I was teaching painting at the School of Visual Arts, and my work was occasionally showing in group shows, so, you know, I was following my dream, and I knew there was this painter named Bud Hopkins, and I just cold called him, and he answered the phone, and I introduced myself and told him I was a painter, and again, you know, teaching at SBA, and that I was recently kind of drawn into this field and had read his article and thought it was great. And he invited me to come over a couple of days later for coffee, and was in 1976. And by the following year, we were spending pretty regular time together, and I had talked to the right people at the School of Visual Arts, because like a lot of schools, especially somewhat offbeat ones, and we certainly were that, they're always looking for interesting speakers for the student body, etc. And I asked them if they'd be interested in having, you know, this guy who had had this experience, Mr. Obarski, and Bud, who was a known painter, who was involved in this now and had done a very nice investigation, and myself, just doing kind of a talk about, you know, UFOs in general. And Bud got hold of a guy named Dick Rule. Dick Rule was an old NICAP guy from out on Long Island. And so the four of us appeared together on the stage of the School of Visual Arts on whatever day it was in 1977. And that was Bud and my very first UFO talk. And so, boy, do I have bragging rights on that. And, you know, 4 years later, anybody who was anybody and seriously involved in UFO studies knew who Bud was. And 43 years after that, they knew who I was.
How long after that? Well, how long after that was it that his first book on the subject came out?
Well, we did our talk in 77, and Missing Time was published in 81. And as I recall, the audience, which was, you know, students and some faculty members at the School of Visual Arts, my alma mater and a place I'm always very proud to be associated with as a former faculty member, they thought it was a great talk, and we got a good round of applause. And I think it was George Obarski's only public appearance anywhere, and he was not... He was not having a good time. He did it because Bud asked him to do it.
I want to do that again.
Yeah, but he was as authentic as the day is long, and I just feel, well, again, very privileged that I had a chance to meet him, and that, you know, our lives got intertwined at that moment, and because by the time he had become, how else can I say, Bud Hopkins, we had already built a friendship based on our love of art and music and popular culture and life in New York City and, you know, a dozen other things. And when he asked me if I was interested in doing some volunteer work around the studio, frankly, I jumped at the chance. And ultimately, when we had a little bit of funding in Intruders Foundation, I drew a very modest amount of money for, I think, a full 2 years or so, and then went back to being a volunteer for the rest of my life. Yes, sir. I sure know how to drive an important Disney, and that motivated me all through my career in ufology.
That's more what most of us in ufology do. I always have to laugh when people say, "Oh, you're
in it for the money."
you made up the story just for the money. Yeah, what money?
Well,
come on.
Yeah, that's stranger than UFOs itself. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's so unfair, too. I mean, it's one thing to say it about researchers and, you know, someone like me, I'm a radio host, okay? I can't even call myself a ufologist. And I'm not in this for the money either.
Even with all the big bucking down from the radio network
there? Yeah, absolutely. Hey. And, you know, people see researchers on TV, they do documentaries. Well, you know what, just because you're on TV doesn't mean you're making tons of money either.
Yeah, and that is the assumption, in part because it should be the assumption. But,
well,
in fact, so many of
us... I used to think that.
Yeah. That was another thing. I mean, I certainly like to be paid for my writing and my public speaking, although, you know, you do benefits and you have a widely sliding scale because you have to. But
right.
When Bud became deeply involved in, after he had spent 7 years doing regressive hypnosis under the tutorage, so to say, distinguished psychotherapist, Aphrodite Clamart. And it's important that people know that before he went off on his own, he had, you know, been trained, and then for 7 years worked under Aphrodite's very careful, you know, eye, not that she was in the room per se, but...
Right, but people like to say, well, he didn't have certification. Well, at that time, very few people did have certification. And really, my impression is that there wasn't such a thing.
Yeah. And he,
get trained.
He
was working under the supervision of a professional.
And I was regressions, and I can remember his technique was extremely contactful, considerate, concerned. I saw him take up to half an hour sometimes to put someone under and to know as well as he could before proceeding with what might be a very, or, you know, a traumatic session for them. He was often bringing people back to some of, if not the most, upsetting time or times in their life, ideally to work through it and to understand it better or remember more about it. And he never, ever led someone to believe something that, I, even just starting to form the words, I find myself getting angry because it's just another one of the wacko accusations that, you know, you're some kind of demented goofball that you believe that aliens have landed and therefore you find ways of suckering in all these weak-minded people to convince them when they're hypnotized that it happened to reinforce your own insane views. And Bud, in the more than... I'm going to say here more than 1,000 regressions that he conducted, and that may be a somewhat conservative figure, and it's not thousands and thousands, but over 1,000, that he never once asked anyone for a penny. This is very important to remember. Yes, his methodology was very scrupulous and very much in the service of the truth rather than some agenda.
I did get to see Bud conducting at least one regression, I think more than one, and I have also seen regressions done by some of the people who worked with him at the Intruders Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have to say, I saw occasionally these people maybe try to lead the witness in a certain direction, but they would never put words in someone's mouth. They would never say, so you saw an alien or something.
Well,
but if someone was describing there's a person coming, they might say, oh, and is his shirt white? And the person might say, no, it's green.
That's right.
They would try to sort of lead to see if the person was suggestible.
Yes, and in fact, is a very important distinction, and thank you for bringing it up, Karen. Yes, it was not uncommon with Bud to lead in the absolute other direction to be brought back. And that is so different. And I give you an example. There was a point not that long ago where I was working with a colleague in the UK, and I'll leave it at that, who brought to my attention an individual in a responsible job who felt that, who knew that they had lifelong experiences, and anyone in their rather macho field knew about this, he would simply lose his career. It could not be tolerated. And within a year, I was in the UK and took a break from a conference. And with my colleague, we excused ourselves for several hours, and we went to a pub where this man had taken the day off and had come in. And we met with him. I was going to say over a beer that I didn't even touch mine. I don't think anybody else did. We were just, was rather an incredible afternoon. And he had already sent us extraordinarily detailed drawings, copies of dreams that he had written out, dreams in quotes. He was looking to come to the States and work with Bud or Dave Jacobs, and I hope that he will be working with Dave this year. But at the time, he very much had decided, after all of, everything that we had told him or asked him, and my first thought is, if somebody says, yes, I do want to explore my memory or my partial memory with a responsible person who is trained to do hypnotic regression, I am still going to say to that person, are you sure? Think about your life for a moment. Wouldn't it be all right with you to know that there is a mystery that you don't know the answer to, but that, you know, you don't have to know the answer to? And no, he had decided he wanted to do it. And there was one hypnotherapist with respect to this subject who already took it seriously, and we had heard some good things about him, and we connected them up, and this gentleman went for a session. And a few days later, I spoke to him on the phone along with my British colleague, and we asked him how it had gone, and he said okay, but there was a lack of enthusiasm, and he's a nice guy and didn't want to make us feel something less about this other guy, but he also knew it was very important to, report what had happened. And he said he seemed very professional. He put me under. He took the subject very seriously. He was enthused. And as we're getting into this, and I'm beginning to describe to, the spot in the sky that ultimately, I know what happened. I'm looking to have it confirmed here. Came down and was, what it was. And his question to me was, quote unquote, what did the spaceship look like? And he said, I was under. But even then, I realized I felt awkward about continuing because it is the functional equivalent of the attorney asking the person on the stand, so when did you stop beating your wife? Mm-hmm. It's not a good question to ask.
Exactly. Wait, what?
No. And we did, we both, my colleague and I, brought this to the attention of the practitioner, who was horrified and very contrite, immediately realized his enthusiasm had gotten the best of him, and mea culpa'd all over the place, and at the same time, we could not recommend that he continue with this man because that bond of trust was, not there, and I hope that this guy got his act together. Anyway, I'm off on a tangent here, but so many people discount the value of extremely responsible hypnotic regression as a part of the investigation of this phenomenon, and the fact is there can be very real value to it.
Right. There's been a pretty lively discourse. While you were talking, there was a question about what does ufology mean? What is ufology? And you said, well, it's the study of UFOs, unidentified objects. It's so you're studying things that can't be identified.
Well, we're doing our best to identify them, and where we can't identify them, to make our peace with that, I guess. But it's an obvious hybrid word, as good as any that anyone has come up for the study of the history of the phenomenon and certain aspects thereof.
Mm-hmm. People have seen objects and lights that sometimes can be identified as mundane objects.
Yeah,
they may be very unusual.
Yeah, an IFO.
Right, but there's always a small percentage that you just can't explain away as swamp gas or experimental aircraft or the planet Venus.
It's true.
And those are the ones that are really fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's why we're here. You know? That's why people come into this field.
It sure is. But, yeah, anything else that's coming up in the chat room, I'd be happy to address.
Well, yes, a couple of questions about Bud, actually. Someone did ask, wanted to know about whether you had had the regression yourself.
I had three. One with Bud, one with another one of my mentors, who was a highly decorated, very tough, no-nonsense, Brooklyn, Italian-American, New York City police detective, who, that was Detective Sergeant Pete Mazzola, who, for anyone familiar with my and Larry Warren's book, Left at East Gate, the first edition of that book, is co-dedicated to him because we lost Pete the week that Larry and I really connected in 1987. Pete had been with the New York City Police Department for over 20 years, and I think it was in the 1970s that he had been one of a very small select group of detectives who were chosen to be trained to conduct regressive hypnosis for criminals. Ooh. And he told me a couple of amazing stories about using criminal investigation in investigating hypnotic regression and investigating criminal crime, well, to conduct investigations in New York City Police Department. And this is a digression, but it's an important one because it underscores the value of this remarkable tool, and then I'll tell you a little about my hypnotic regressions. Some of your longtime New York City listeners may actually remember this, like I've gone back over 30 years now, but it was a very famous murder. And it was all over the papers until it was solved. And it was called Murder at the Met. It was set against an amazing Cold War scenario, and now that I think of it, it would make a great film. The Bolshoi Ballet was beginning a national American tour, and they were beginning at Lincoln Center, where they're going to be in New York City for a week, and then for the next few months, they were going to travel to appropriate, you know, performance spaces around the United States. And while they were there, and remember, of course, this is at a very heightened point in the Cold War, a young violinist named Helen Agnes Mintix, funny the things that stick in your mind, I think she was 20, and she was found dead, strangled, on the roof of either the Metropolitan Opera House or the Symphony Space Performing Hall as part of the Lincoln Center complex. Mm. Well, not only was it a murder, but it was a murder while you've got dozens and dozens of Russians here beginning a goodwill tour, all, as I recall, you know, kind of outside of the normal rules of, you know, they've got diplomatic, if not immunity. This is a very, very, very touchy situation, and they're only going to be in New York for a few days. So the NYPD had to use some extraordinary thinking out of the box here. And this is where Pete came in. He and a police sketch artist and a Russian translator, okay? They've got this team of three people working together, and one by one, they are interviewing everybody in the Bolshoi Ballet and all of the tech people and support people that are with them. So it's a big crew of people. And at a certain point, they're interviewing a young ballerina who vaguely remembers being in one of the elevators with this woman. They showed her a picture. And a man. And that's all she remembered. So Pete puts her completely under. And then again, working with a Russian translator and a police artist, she gives them a description. And they end up with a sketch. And when he brings her out of the hypnotic regression, he shows it to her, and she says, yes, that looks like it. And they bring this sketch to, I think, the stage manager at the Met, and says, have you seen a guy that looks like this? He says, yeah, he's over there. That's Craig Crimmins. He's like a third generation stagehand here. And they confront him right there backstage at the Met. And they said, Pete told me that Crimmins looked at the sketch, looked at the cops, and said, don't hurt me. And they took him in, and he admitted it. Yeah.
Oh, my
amazing,
gosh.
Right? Well, Pete hypnotized me, and Bud hypnotized me, and a friend of mine had been certified to do hypnotic work, also hypnotized me over the period of about 2 years, because the thing that had gotten me into this was my recovered memory of an incredible sighting, the sighting that I had had with my sister Helen, which I've talked about on and off certainly since I got involved in this field years ago. And I wanted to know if there was more, or if there was a lot more, and nothing shook loose except for one or two very fine details that confirmed my and Helen's memories of that event. But I wanted not just to confirm in my mind that that was it for me, and I thought it was important to do it with several different people. I also wanted to know what it was like to be really hypnotized. And I found it amazingly educational and completely fascinating, Karen. People go under in different ways, so to say. There are people that are they're just frightened, and for all the right reasons. And the Pete Mazzola, for example, said, you know, this happened to you and Helen on the front lawn. And he also hypnotized my sister several times. And if you get anxious, you know, we know that if you were up in your parents' bedroom, because their bedroom window was in the front of the house, and somebody was standing there, they could have looked down on you while this was happening, or looked up into the sky and seen, you know, the discs that you guys saw. If you get anxious, you can, you know, put yourself up in that room. I thought, that's cool. Other people will come out of it or have a very intellectualized experience. You know, they'll experience it in their head. And then there are those of us that apparently aren't really heavily armored around our experiences and go very deeply into what's called alpha state. I'll tell you what, I was 14 years old again. I'm not kidding you, Karen. And I listened a couple of years ago the last time, but I've got the transcript, and it's me at 14. It's not me pretending to be 14. I'm there. I can smell the grass. I'm wearing, you know, my kids and a polo shirt, not a T-shirt, and dungarees and not, you know, jeans. And I'm using words and phrases that I wouldn't, you know, I haven't used since I was a kid. It was terribly moving. It was really a very special experience, or small series of experiences for me. But that is not the way it goes down, you know, with everyone. But I am, I think it was very important that I did that, in the same way that when I trained, I had my lay training with Samaritans International to work as a crisis intervention volunteer on the busy line in America. We weren't make-believe psychiatrists or anything. We were good listeners, but part of our training was, for example, I had to go to several AA meetings because I was going to be dealing with people with substance abuse problems, you know, inevitably, of course, on the phone, and folks that might be having an episode at that time, and I had to know something about the experience of recovery. So, you know, I would say that was very valuable to me. And if there are folks out there that are even thinking about working with people who, you know, may be regressively hypnotized, it certainly couldn't hurt to have a little firsthand appreciation, even if it's somewhat symbolic, of the experience, and go forward from there.
Yeah.
Anyway, about my hypnotic regression, remembered. And as you know, and many people that have followed my public speaking or writing know, I got into this because my sister Helen had abduction experiences, and we first talked about it in February of 1975, when this was, you know, it was a pretty arcane subject, and I just thought my sister was crazy.
So she just came and told you about it, and I was just about to say, you know, what did you think? It's so funny, Peter, talking with you, because all evening, just as a question is forming in my head, you answer it.
Well, yeah. We had had this sighting as kids, and it really freaked me out. We saw five silvery white disc-shaped objects over the house that we grew up in on Long Island, New York, and there was nothing ambiguous about it. It was a beautiful, clear day. They were fully articulated. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. I watched them come in at a high rate of speed with no sound, and I looked up and I called. We were playing on the front lawn, just kind of goofing around, and I called her attention to it with either by saying her name or saying, look, and we did. And I went through an experience that I'm sure I've documented with easy a couple of hundred people over the decades who have related their sighting accounts to me, and I call it the checklist phenomena. You simply look up, and your logical mind rattles off some, they're not, or it's not, a plane, a helicopter, a balloon, a kite, a dirigible, a bird, a strange-shaped cloud reflection from the ground, a bit of flotsam, you know, flying through the air, or what the hell is it? And at the time, being 14 years old, I was pretty much running on hormonal energy and the desire to have some cool clothes and to be, you know, I was a very nerdy, cheerfully geeky kid. At 14, I was still in the Boy Scouts. I was not into sports at all, but I was a pretty good cook, and I loved to paint and draw, and I collected rocks and stamps and coins and bugs and, you know, I mean, I was Leave It to Beaver, for Christ's sakes. I was just, you know, having a very innocent childhood and an overall very positive one. And all of a sudden, here's this. And I know, I'm not stupid. I mean, I know that, you know, I've seen my share of those films. They were fun, you know, the B-films that are of my era, some of them black and white, some not. But I also, you know, in retrospect, I realize I implicitly bought the unspoken message of the adult world that, of course, flying saucers are real in the movies and in fiction, but obviously not, or we'd all know it. But all of us, they were disc-shaped. They didn't have tails. They didn't have wings. They were silvery. We could actually make out detailing around the edge, slightly off, yellowish, that to both of us only read like windows would on a commercial airplane. It was shattering. And it was so shattering that I basically decided that day that if I talked to any of my buddies in junior high school, as we used to call middle school then, that word would go out. And how can I say this? Sex was something I was starting to think about, like, all the time. And the only thing I knew about it was that I really was very interested in it and wanted some. And that,
and
you know how girls are.
Like a good way to get one.
Well, you know how girls are. You critters talk. And I knew that if I said this to anybody in junior high school, they'd tell somebody else. It would get to a girl. Every other girl in the world would find out. I would never have sex in my life. I, you know, I'm saying it in a lighthearted way, but that really, really had something to do with it. I didn't want to be singled out as any quirkier than I was. And so, that afternoon, Helen said, do you want to talk about this? And I made it clear that I didn't. And who knew about, you know, repressed memory trauma? All I know is that 14 and a half years later, I'm a young painter living in Chinatown. I'm living my dream, and for reasons I think I can sort out why it came up on that day, it came up like a freight train, and within 15 minutes, this was like a tape loop flying through my mind, and I just broke down. I thought I must be going crazy. I knew it. I didn't believe that I had forgotten it. How could anybody do that? And I really had to calm myself down. And ultimately, I did. Had a cup of tea, thought out my options, and realized, well, I've got to call Helen. My sister at the time was an aspiring poet and bohemian, living a mile or so north of me in the East Village. And I asked her if it was a good time to talk. And I told her that I had remembered something from when we were kids, and I wanted to know if she remembered what she remembered about it. But at least I had had, I had thought it out enough to say, I'm afraid if I tell you what I remembered, you'll say yes or no. And I'm sure you're telling the truth, but I'll never, you know, let me just set the scene. And I began to do just that. I told her what kind of day it was, about the time of day. It was late morning. What the weather was like, where we were standing on the front lawn. And she stopped me, Karen, mid-sentence, and said, stop, I know what you're talking about. And went on with, like, one parameter difference. We remembered that it was a precise military V, so to say, you know, mm-hmm. five of these. And she wasn't sure whether it was five or six, but within a day we got together, and I just started drawing these things like crazy, that, you know, from then on for a while. But we realized it had to be an odd number. But we agreed, and there was that sort of epiphany moment of, oh, my God, they're real. Oh, my God, they're real. Very split. But then she said, there's more, and you're not going to like it, and went on to tell me, among other things, of what you and I would now say, oh, yeah, that's an archetypical series of memories of a classic alien abduction. But this is 1975, and this was hardly the stuff of lots of books or talk shows or documentaries. The Hill case was out there for people that were into this kind of thing, but that sure wasn't us. And for a series of seconds, I reacted by thinking to myself, oh my God, Helen's gone crazy. And then catching myself and saying, ah, but
wait, I saw it.
Seconds earlier when she wasn't crazy, it was just fine to see five mm-hmm. flying saucers over the Parker's house.
Right.
Like Dear David Jacobs.
Yeah.
The bottom line, though, is that she described to me being lifted off the ground, her hair flying in the wind of the bottom of one of these things getting larger and larger, not being afraid, being fascinated, then a series of beings, a bunch of little archetypical grays, a very big gray, the voice in her head that was, you know, we've seen you before, we've seen you again, we love you, we won't hurt you, and ouch, then they hurt her and she's on a table. And when we finally started to talk about this, it was an amazing development in our relationship. We had always been close, but this really was something else again. And I said, my God, you know, it's been almost 15 years. What have you been thinking? He said, well, I never forgot it. But, you know, you're my brother. I love you. I respect you. You had said no. One day led to the next week, led to the next month, and the next year, here we are. But if you hadn't told me this, if we hadn't talked about it now, I would have brought it up at, you know, literally within the next few weeks. And at that point, I was really taken aback and said, why? And she said, I've been having the most extraordinary series, the most extraordinary repeating super real dream. It's like not a dream, but I don't know what else to call it. And it was always the same of her in a room on a table being looked at by these beings. And, you know, it's a figure of speech to say my life changed overnight. My life changed in a few minutes. And you know what? Mm-hmm. I resented the hell out of it. All I ever wanted to be was a painter. I just wanted to be an artist. I knew it from the time I was five. And I played at it for years. I continued to teach. I continued to show my work. But a certain amount of the heart had gone out of it for me, and here I am now, making hundreds of dollars a year. you know, I think about, you know, my creative life and teaching and working in the arts and possibly having evolved into a viable, successful, you know, New York-based painter, or having stayed in theater management off-Broadway, which I loved doing for quite a number of years. Any one of them would have been so much more practical than mm-hmm. this career. So if you do want to follow this route, folks, unless you are...
Don't quit your day job.
Mrs. Romney's sons and have a mild little trust fund. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well said, Karen.
I have a day job. You know.
Way to go. Someday maybe I'll have one again.
And now I have health insurance, too. It's really
good. Whoa, excuse me for living. Wow, Missy, get sick anytime you want then.
I know, I'm getting all full of myself now. This is great.
Take respect.
I know, it's just so funny to hear people who are skeptical. You know, we talked earlier about regressive hypnosis and how the skeptics say, oh, yeah, the guy doing the hypnosis puts those images in the person's head. And, you know, we both have seen it. Anyone who has actually had the opportunity to witness one of these regressions can see easily that, you know, these people try very hard not to do that. There will be some tests to see how suggestible the person is, but they don't say, so you saw the aliens, or, you know, so the spaceship landed, and then what happened?
Now, that is not to say that there are not irresponsible, belief-oriented, mystically driven, very nice people in our
field.
That's true. But as far as I'm concerned, they're total space cadets and goofballs, and they confuse empirical fact with belief. They confuse or choose not to differentiate between actual evidence and what they hope for or have faith in. For me, when somebody says, when people start using numbers, there are, you know, 137 civilizations that have been visiting the Earth from other planets for 40,000 years. This is the Pleiadians, and this is why they're here. This is how they dress. This is what they eat, and this is the craft they're in. And these are those folks from the Dog Star, and these ones are the Nordics, and these ones are. May well be. I don't know. But to say you know, as opposed to you believe, you have faith in, you think, you hope, is, to paraphrase Mark Twain, the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning, and I think it's irresponsible. I hope in warm regard as friends, but I could not disagree with them less on the way they approach their investigations, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, that's true. There will always be some people who just, they believe that they have the answers, that they know the truth. And you know what? They could very well be deceived.
Yep.
They could be right.
You know, that's just it. Who are any of us to say without, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt?
Exactly. And I get this all the time, and you must get this frequently too, Peter, because you speak at so many conferences, and you're well known and well respected as an authority in this field. And I'm sure a lot of people do ask you, well, who are they and what are they here for?
Yeah. And that's,
you know,
fine.
I get asked
those
that. I'm like,
questions.
I don't know.
The other ones will tell you why they're here. Okay. And that is something else again. I did a radio show on the Inception Radio Network.
Just the other night, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it went just great. And I had the pleasure of answering several questions, you know, good questions from the radio audience, just like we always get from Through the Keyhole, with an answer that I'm very proud to give sometimes, which is, I don't know. And I find that some of our colleagues don't like to give that answer because, well, they're known as an authority on the subject, and they should have something to say about whatever the heck they were asked about, but I don't know, and I can tell you the one thing I am sure of after 35 years in this field is I don't really know what's going on, but I have some very strong ideas, I have my own beliefs, and I can make better educated guesses than most people can based on my experience and studies. And I also have dear, respected colleagues that I can pick cases. you know, you and Rich being among them, we're, I just feel very fortunate that not only have we kind of evolved into, you know, knowing each other professionally, but we really have become good friends. And it's not just because we're New Yorkers and, you know, you live in Rochester and I live in the woods.
I'm not a New Yorker.
Oh, right, right. No, you're a
Rochester thing going on.
Oh, right, of course. No, Rich and I are the Long Island boys.
That's right.
Yeah.
No, I'm still in my hometown here.
Yeah. Way to go.
Yep.
But
I got that nasal Rochester accent. I'm amazed that I'm on radio, actually.
And all over the world. It's not just regional.
No.
Well, you know.
I was listening to the radio here in my car today as I was driving home from work, and I thought, oh, my God, the Rochester accents.
I listen to depending on the time of day or night, I can sometimes pick up four different NPR affiliates where I am, and I listen on and off. And there's one that comes out of your fair city, and it's always, they give the call letters, and the guy says, Rochester, and whoop.
Yes.
I know that one.
Yeah, they are fun. Although I have to say, I have been told, too, that I sound Canadian.
Hey, so well, that's because you look pretty close up to the line there.
Yep, I think that's it. Picking it up by osmosis.
That's not a bad thing.
My son does a really good Canadian accent.
He is a quick wit. There's no question about that. Yeah.
He is.
Between the two of them, I think that they may run the world at some point in the future. So,
they're running his house now.
Well, duh. As you know, I'm doing all I can to endear myself to both of them and stay on the right side of them.
Okay.
Because I sense their future power.
Yeah. They both did ask me to say hello to you, by the way. They were very pleased when they heard that you were going to be my guest this evening.
All right. Well, please send my love and best wishes back to both of them. And yes, tell them that the larger of the regulation issue Tiger Cats that we played with at Jennifer and Michael's is now a resident of this house as of tonight.
I will tell them.
That's big news, considering how much
Great.
Time the four
it
of us
is.
Spent in the cat room downstairs when we were at Mike's.
Oh, I know. Every time we couldn't find anytime I couldn't find Peter, I'd say, oh, I'm just going to go check the room where the cats are. There you are. It's so nice to just retreat to the cat room.
Oh, God, it was great fun. It was great,
great
fun. So when you visit again, I don't know if he'll be meowing with a Philadelphia accent, but...
Yes. Well, we do only have a few minutes left, and there's one caller listener has been exceedingly patient and has asked this question a couple of times.
Please.
Whether either Bud Hopkins, when he had his experiences, or whether you and your sister, when you had your contact experiences, did you ever feel or get any impression that these beings were showing themselves to you specifically for a reason?
Well, let me say at the outset here, had a sighting, and that is very different than an experience. So let me split infinitives
right.
here, and I wouldn't want anybody to think otherwise because...
Right, I was using the word experience in the more generic way, but thank you for catching that.
Yeah, it's a great question, and as I said, one of the things that Helen heard in her head, which is not uncommon for abductees or experiencers who are interfacing with these other life forms or other intelligences, whatever euphemism you want to use. One of the phrases that we have documented repeatedly is, you're special. Now, maybe they're saying it to you because it's true or because they want you to feel that way. I don't know. Helen, as far as I'm concerned, my sister was special, and I say was because we lost her in 2000, but I don't know. We do know, in reasonable doubt, that this is something that runs in some families, and that it comes down from, you know, a parent who seems to have had the experience to... their child. I know that sounds far-fetched to some people, but there's so much actual evidence that we now have that supports this very real construct. So I don't know how to answer that question. I wish I did, and I thank the listener for their patience. I know for me, what I saw, it was a special moment in my life. Had, you know, I saw UFOs when I was researching left at Eastgate in England on a very, on one time. There are people that seem to have this, or see objects that they can't explain or have these contact experiences throughout a good part of their lives. It was a special experience to me, but did I feel it was, you know, something because I was special? No, not really. And I think we're talking about something that's very subjective here, and that I don't know how we would establish it in fact, because even if you're told you're special, deception seems to run through many events as much as it does human being to human being. We're not always honest with each other. In fact, it's sadly often the case that there is deception or duplicity or an ulterior motive involved. So I'm sorry, I can't give a better answer there.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Peter. And on that note, we are going to have to end it. I can't believe we blew through 2 hours.
Not quite. I got an extra 10 minutes because of our new kitty cat. But
that's
Karen,
true.
As always with you, it's like a missing time experience. Where does it go?
No, we just have so much fun.
I want you to please send my love to the family. A big hug to you. In touch soon. And thank you. Well, thank you, your audience, for giving me an opportunity to rattle on here.
Well, it's been a pleasure, as always, Peter. Thank you so much. And when the snow clears a bit and the roads are passable, we'll have to get together again.
Yeah, I'll look forward to it. In fact, I'll be coming up through your way in March. I'll be speaking again at Niagara County Community College.
And, oh, fantastic.
And in April, I'm going to be heading up to speak to your sister meetup group there in Toronto, the great Cookie Stringfellow, our commander-in-chief in that unit. And other than that, over and out for the moment, and I'll look forward to returning to the show if you invite me back.
Very soon, I'm sure.
Okay.
Great. Thanks so much, Peter.
Bye for now.
And good night. And I want to thank all of our listeners. You guys really put in some fantastic questions in the chat room. Thank you so much. I always enjoy the conversation even more when we get audience participation. It's a lot more fun. You have been listening to Through the Keyhole live on the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.7 FM in New Orleans. Once again, I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and I'd like to thank my guest, Peter Robbins, and my producer, Joe Montaldo. Archives are available at iTunes and also at media.theblackvault.com. Search under UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Right now, stay tuned for Global Focus, up next with Tree Sheridan. Thanks, everyone. See you next time.